What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Conflict between Israel and Palestine, of course, has been escalating this week. Today we have two segments about Palestinians. Later in the show, we'll talk about Edward Said. He was the leading voice of Palestinians in the United States before he died in 2003. Adam Schatz will talk about his life in Palestinian politics. Edward Said was also The Nation's classical music critic, and Adam Schatz was The Nation's literary editor. His work included editing Edward Said's pieces for the magazine. But first, Rachel Kushner. Her new book, The Hard Crowd, includes an unforgettable essay about her visit to a Palestinian refugee camp. Her novels, The Mars Room, The Flamethrowers, and Telex from Cuba, have been translated into 26 languages and won many awards. We've talked about them here. The essays in The Hard Crowd are about politics, art, literature, music, and motorcycles, and they appeared originally in the New York Times Magazine, the LRB, the Paris Review, Art Forum, and the New Yorker. We reached her today at home in LA. Rachel, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Nice to be here.
Well, the Palestinian refugee camp you wrote about in The Hard Crowd is not in Gaza or southern Lebanon. It's actually inside Jerusalem. I knew nothing about this. It's called Shuafat. Of course, your essay is not about the current crisis in Jerusalem and the efforts of right-wing Jews there to push Palestinians out of some of the Palestinian neighborhoods around Shuafat. You visited in 2016 when something called the Knife Intifada was going on. But your report is about ordinary life for Palestinian refugees at that time and in that place. What's going on now in Israel and Palestine is so much worse. We're speaking on Wednesday. When you were in Shuafat, Israeli planes were not bombing Gaza and killing children. Israeli forces had not attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem at the end of Ramadan and injured hundreds of Palestinians. I almost said that when you were in Shuafat in 2016, things were more peaceful. But that's not really the right way to describe it.
Yeah, I would say, I could see how one would use that expression compared to now, that it was relatively peaceful. But going there as I did and witnessing what to me very much looked like apartheid, and in fact, representatives from South Africa who had been a part of the truth and reconciliation process had gone to the West Bank and said that apartheid wasn't quite the right term because what they witnessed there was so much more extreme in terms of there being two different systems for two different populations of people. In any case, going there and witnessing what looked like apartheid and seeing the constant violence and humiliation that was enacted by Israel to maintain that apartheid is never peaceful. The year that I was there was the Intifada of the knife, when young people with nothing to lose charged at Israeli soldiers with knives in their hands. Just these totally futile acts of despair. And my feeling by the time I left Israel and Palestine was I was stunned to think that the Palestinian people were not running at Israeli soldiers in despair every second of their waking lives. And it was the opposite of what you'd think. You think you would ask yourself, how could these kids decide to end it all? You know, it's a version of suicide by cop, running at a soldier with a knife in your hand, a soldier that's armed to the teeth, moreover wearing, you know, knife-proof, bulletproof, all kinds of personal body armor. My question was the opposite. How are they not doing that all the time because of the extreme nature of their predicament and the torture and humiliation of it? So that was my personal takeaway. And I think that part of Israel's trick is to leave us with a lack of language, where peace is not the right term for a momentary absence of terror, such as the time when I went, when, as you say, Israel was not actively bombing buildings that were full of children in Gaza.
Your visit to Shuafat was a big deal for the people who live there. It seems like they were all happy to see you and happy to talk to you. Partly that was because you obviously cared about them and were interested in them, but also it was because of your guide, a wonderful man named Baha Nababta, 29-year-old community organizer. In some ways, it's a story about him. How did you and Baha find each other?
I was invited to go to the West Bank in 2016 by the writers Michael Chabon and Ayelet Waldman, who were putting together an anthology to mark the 50th anniversary of the occupation of 1967. And the book is called Kingdom of Olive and Ash. And they had liaised with an incredible array of different kinds of contacts on the ground in the West Bank, from community organizers of youth groups in cities like Hebron and Ramallah, to architects who are experts on the tripartite division that Israel uses to code areas and how they are controlled and the level to which they are controlled, to philosophers and historians, poets. We traveled all over the West Bank for a week and met with people multiple times a day. I mean, we would be roused, for instance, at 4 a.m. to go to a checkpoint at Kalandia and talk to the woman there who's been monitoring that checkpoint for the last 40 years and talking to her about the difference between merely being a witness to humanitarian crimes and doing something more. And she is more on the side now of doing something more. At the end of that long and intensive and concentrated week, we each were given a weekend where we had chosen a specific subtopic that we wanted to write about for the anthology. And then they, long before the trip, had organized, arranged everything and connected us to the contacts that we would need for our weekend away from the group doing whatever we'd chosen to do. And just on instinct alone, before I went, I was not knowledgeable about the history of Palestine. I was dimly aware the way most people would be, and dimly aware also of like where my affinities and sympathies might lie. But I really knew very little about the history of that conflict. And on instinct, I decided I wanted to see what life was like inside one of these refugee camps that's been functioning, where people thus are forced to make a life generation after generation for decades now. And what does that mean? These are not temporary camps at this point. And obviously the really famous or more notorious camps are inside Lebanon. And I knew people who had written, you know, academic books about these camps and et cetera. But I saw on the map that there was a camp inside the borders of Israel, and it's called Shuafat. There's also a neighborhood called Shuafat, and that should not be confused for the camp because they are very different. That's basically a middle-class neighborhood. Shuafat refugee camp has 85,000 residents who live in roughly 1 square kilometer. And I knew that and just asked myself, how do those people live? and what kind of self-government goes on in that camp, because the Palestinian Authority is not allowed into the camp. It is Israeli territory. But Israel does not service the camp. There's no water service. There's no electricity. There's no emergency services. There are virtually no schools. There's no land registration. There's no paved roads. There's no garbage service. So how do these people live? And the organizers who worked with Michael Chabon and Ayelet Waldman, one of them, Muriel Rothman-Zecker, who's a writer and an organizer who'd been living and working in the West Bank for many years, knew of Baha Nababta and connected me to him. And we went into the camp together and met with Baha. And Muriel served as my Arabic interpreter for quite a while the first day I was there. And then he left, and it was me and Baha alone, and I stayed with his family for a weekend and talked to him quite a bit about the camp, about his family, his history. He was born in the camp. Believe his father may have also been born in the camp. His children were all born in the camp, and what kind of future they saw for themselves, and also why people live in that camp.
Have you been in touch with or heard anything about what's been going on in the last week or month there?
Really, just through the news. I've been busy and preoccupied with some family issues, so I haven't had the time I'd like to, read everything that's happened. And I like to follow Breaking the Silence, former Israeli military people who have stepped up to, speak about their experiences in the military. And I'm on their newsletter, email list, and read what they have to say about it. They haven't sent out a report yet. I will say that reading about the destruction in Gaza and the killing of children living in housing blocks in Gaza does remind me of my trip in 2016, because one of the people on our trip, the writer Dave Eggers, went to Gaza. I went to Shuafat. Dave went to Gaza. And in order to go into Gaza, he had to get several different documents stamped by both the Israeli government and Hamas. And the people living in Gaza, we've all heard over the years, are trapped there and cannot leave. And in a way, there is a similar predicament in Shuafat. In fact, I met people from Gaza in Shuafat who had, originally in Gaza were trapped there. And then once they got to Shuafat, were trapped in Shuafat because Gazans are not allowed to really be anywhere. But inside of Shuafat, since Israel doesn't service that camp, they don't bother with people who are there without papers, without documentation. And if you're there and you don't have, a green documentation that allows you to travel in the West Bank, and you don't have documentation that allows you to travel in Israel, you're basically stuck inside this 1 kilometer camp. And the Israeli military has invaded that camp in the past. And having been there, I think I could understand just in a tiny way, which is better than nothing at all, understand what it's like to be stuck in a territory that's being bombarded by the Israeli military.
So when you were there, you moved around with Baha as people talked to him about what they needed, what they wanted him to help with. What sorts of things did they turn to him for?
My impression of him was that he sort of was like a de facto mayor of the place, although the term mayor is a little problematic because that suggests politics. And I think that Baha transcended politics, maybe in the way that the most effective politicians do. He seemed like a trusted source that people could go to for a whole variety of problems. The first thing I saw him deal with was a lack of water in one of the unregistered, not up to code high-rise buildings that people are forced to live in there. This building had no water and had had no water for a few days. They sort of take water illegally from lines that pass near Shuafat, and they are forced to do that. And they were having a problem, and Baha's phone kept ringing and he wasn't answering. And finally he said to me, it's the people calling from this building here, and pointed to this towering high-rise building. And he said, I can't answer yet because I really don't have a solution for them to offer. But he was trying to work with the facilities people who are kind of renegade facilities people who can figure out how to solve the problem of getting water to this building. I remember another problem was a man whose baby had died in a clinic, and the man wanted to kill the doctor who had attended to the situation with this baby. And it was one of those situations that, without knowing much about it, I would say is a symptom of a lack of a useful, helpful civil structure where people resort to revenge out of grief. And not just that, but a symptom of the lack of decent medical care that people can turn to. And so Baja was forced to deal with a lot of very complex situations that arise in a place that doesn't have a civil structure.
What did Baja mean when he told you, we need police here?
Well, to be quite honest, and part of what I write about in that essay is what I heard in terms of what fit with a narrative that I was sort of constructing in my mind as I was with him, and what I wrote down but didn't really think about in the moment. I mean, I was taking in a lot of information in just a few days' time and really just trying to be in that place. For me, it wasn't really a political engagement. It was me trying to write down sense impressions and be sensitive to what people were telling me. And the piece that I wrote was meant to, I guess I wanted people who read it to feel that they would have had the same reactions that I did, that it was just about a person being plunged into, immersed in an environment that was foreign to her. And yet the people in it still had so much dignity and humanity and decency. And I reacted to that. The detail about Baja telling me that they wanted police there was something that I wrote down in my notebook, but quickly kind of, I guess I would say I repressed it because it didn't really fit with my ideas for the place. And yes, you know, I'm no real fan of the function of police in society, who are sort of, you know, to clunkily summarize, there to protect private property and those who own property. But Baja, coming from a place that is caught between two different authorities, not attended to by the government of Israel, not attended to by the Palestinian Authority, has been overrun by opportunists who themselves are a product of a place that has experienced war and a deeply ignobling treatment by the Israeli military for decades now. And so naturally there are young people there who are more brutal in their perception of how to get ahead. And there are people in the camp who regard the lawlessness as useful for their own endeavors, be it like selling drugs or making money in other ways. And, you know, you can buy an apartment in Shuafat refugee camp for a lot less money than you would, for instance, be able to buy an apartment for in Israel proper, so to speak, proper. But there are people who could take that apartment away from you at gunpoint at any moment, and there's nothing you can do. So that's part of what Baja, I think, was speaking to, is a lawlessness and opportunism that he was trying, you know, to push back against. And I believe that that's what ended up getting him assassinated in the street in the middle of the day in front of 100 people.
Yeah, I have to say, when I read that part at the end, I shouted unintentionally, no. And my wife came into the room and said, what happened? What's wrong? And I said, I was sort of embarrassed. And I said, oh, I'm just reading Rachel Kushner's book. But it is something horrible and something huge that ends this essay.
Yeah, it was devastating to learn that. And the people who had organized my trip into the camp let me know I was getting on an airplane. It was 10 days after I left. I was traveling to do something, to go talk to students at Hunter College. And they called me and said, you know, we're very sorry. We need to tell you that Baha was killed. And it was unbelievable to me. I had not felt that I was inviting that kind of violence into my life by going there. But in fact, in a way, I was. And your reaction of, oh, no, I think was shared by people who knew Baha very well. There were activists, you know, even Israeli activists who'd worked with Baha who don't recognize their own government, architects I knew who'd worked with him, who kind of work on these issues of trying to reestablish services to Shu'afat, who said, it's always the good ones. It's always the good ones. Yeah. People who, you know, are not divisive, who are optimists and positive without being unrealistic, who have a natural grace. And Baha had a natural grace. And I think it was really devastating and demoralizing to people that he died in this way.
When you leave the camp, you do write, everything, I quote, everything seems hopeless and obscene. And that's even before Baha got killed.
Well, yeah, that was after I met the child of a friend of Baha, who's a co-organizer with him of a voluntary emergency response system, where without fire, medical, or ambulance services, they have a WhatsApp group where they try to be on call for emergencies. And the goal is to get people through the Israeli checkpoint on the border of the camp back into Jerusalem so they can go to a hospital. And many people have died being carried on stretchers through that checkpoint. This incident had happened beyond Shu'afat, where a school bus full of children had crashed on a wet road and turned over and caught fire. And it was a totally devastating incident for the people of Shu'afat camp. And I mean, it's hard to talk about, but this young woman that I met, she, I believe, was 8 years old, had been very badly burned and injured in that fire. And her father, Adele, you know, wheeled her out in her wheelchair to meet me. And she was very sweet and patient, didn't understand English, and was asked to sit there and kind of pretend that she understood and was paying attention. And it was an unbearable situation, but it was also life for these people. And they were asking me to bear witness to their life and to this girl. And I did that, but also tried to explain what was difficult about it in the essay that I wrote that's in the book.
Well, I'm sorry that we're running out of time. There's a lot more in this book that I'd love to talk about. You have a wonderful profile of Ruth Gilmore, our leading prison abolitionist. A lot of wonderful stuff about motorcycles. I guess I should just ask you to explain, what does the title mean, The Hard Crowd?
Yeah, it's true. You didn't ask me about any of the fun stuff, John. Right. It's right to the misery. Which, you know, I don't think that essay is actually miserable. But The Hard Crowd is, well, it's the title of the book, but it's also the title of the final essay in the book, which is a kind of, I guess, remembrance of youth, memory, adolescence, and those parts of adulthood that one will never revisit again because they are gone forever. The Hard Crowd is a line I stole from a Cream song called White Room that I've always loved and remember having heard in a head shop when I was probably 10 or 11 years old, growing up in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury. And to me, it's an evocative and strange grouping of words. It's not the tough crowd, you know, like a suspicious or unreceptive audience, or the tough crowd like Marlon Brando in Hollister, California, looking for something to rebel against. It's something else, and it could mean different things in different parts of the book. But in that final essay, I guess it's those who committed themselves totally and ardently to the present tense in a way that a writer, I think, cannot, because the noticer removes herself by virtue of her noticing.
And you say that in The Hard Crowd, you were the soft one, which is, I guess, why you're here today and some of them are not.
I don't know if I would have seemed all that soft if you'd met me then, okay. But it's a way to sort of make a proposition about difference. And also, I have often felt that people who have star quality are kind of up there for me among my friends. And I like to write about people as though they are stars. So in that way, I kind of position myself as the one who doesn't have those same qualities to which I'm paying homage.
One last thing before we close, I have to ask Rachel Kushner, are you related to Jared Kushner?
I think you've asked me that before, John.
Every time. I always have to check in and make sure.
My husband trollingly refers to him as Cousin Jared, which makes us all laugh. As far as I know, there is no actual relation.
Rachel Kushner, her wonderful new book is The Hard Crowd. Rachel, thanks for all your work and thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, John. Always a pleasure.
There's a new biography of Edward Said. He died in 2003. In addition to being the leading American advocate for Palestinians and the author of Orientalism, one of the key scholarly books of the later 20th century, he was also classical music critic for The Nation and wrote about Palestine for the magazine. Adam Schatz was The Nation's literary editor for much of that time. Now he's U.S. editor for the LRB, the London Review of Books. He also writes for the New York Review, the New York Times Magazine, the New Yorker, and other publications. He's also been a visiting professor at Bard and at NYU. We reached him today at home in Brooklyn. Adam Schatz, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, this new biography is called Places of Mind. It's written by Timothy Brennan, and it gives us a chance to talk about Edward Said. He was born in Jerusalem in 1935. His parents were Palestinian Christians. He was an American citizen. You open your piece in the new LRB back in 1963, when a young Edward Said joined the English department at Columbia. And people were spreading a rumor about him. What was the rumor?
The rumor, John, was that he was a Jew from Alexandria.
And what do you make of that?
Well, it's certainly entertaining, and it's also amusing because, in a sense, as I suggest in this piece, he might as well have been a Jew from Alexandria. He had grown up mostly in Cairo. Many of his schoolmates were Middle Eastern Jews. His piano instructor, Ignaz Tigerman, a renowned specialist in the Romantic repertoire who ran a school in Cairo, was a Polish-Jewish refugee. So it's not as though the intellectual culture of secular Judaism was foreign to Said.
His parents, his father in particular, wanted him to get an American education, so they got him into a elite prep school. And then he went to Princeton in the 50s, a really conservative place during a conservative era. What was that like for him?
Princeton was a very conservative school, but Said did manage, I think, to find his intellectual vocation there as a literary critic. He developed close relationships, friendships that would last through much of his lifetime with people like the future art critic Michael Fried, and Said continued his work as a musician. In fact, when he was at Princeton, he was still flirting with the idea of a career as a concert pianist. Eventually, of course, he chose literature.
He was a young faculty member at Columbia when the campus became a kind of a world center of anti-war action in 1967 and 68. And his politics also changed dramatically in 1967 and 68, but not because of Vietnam.
He was certainly sympathetic to the campaign against the war in Vietnam. He was not a supporter of the war in Vietnam. He had already developed fierce anti-imperialist convictions. But he was rather traditionalist in his view of the university as a safe haven and sanctuary for intellectual inquiry. And he did not appreciate it when students came to his class and wanted to shut down the classroom. He threatened to call security. Vietnam, I think, was a far less passionate concern to him than the emergence of the Palestinian guerrilla movement. 1968 was a very important year in the struggle for Palestine. It was the time of the Battle of Karameh, which was a battle by Palestinian guerrillas, Fedayeen in Jordan, against the invading Israeli army. The Palestinians lost that battle, but fought very bravely. And so a myth emerged around the Battle of Karameh, and that helped to propel the PLO forward. Saeed made his first trip to Jordan in 1969, and a year later, he met Yasser Arafat. 1967, the Arab defeat by Israel, and then 68, the emergence of the Palestinian guerrilla movement. This was a critical time in the formation of his political consciousness.
And then in 1978, after 20 years as a basically conventional English professor in terms of his academic work, he published Orientalism, which changed pretty much everything for him and for the humanities. In The New Yorker, Pankaj Mishra calls Orientalism a book that launched 1,000 academic careers. Why was that book so huge and important?
Right, and perhaps that's even an understatement. What Saeed did in that book was to argue that the image that we have of the East, he paid a special attention to the Middle East and to some extent to South Asia, was a construction of an imperialist West. In fact, the very production of Western knowledge about the societies of the Middle East was geared towards furthering and consolidating a whole system of power and domination over these societies.
Orientalism was misunderstood, of course. Edward was not an enemy of Western civ. He always loved what we call the canon of great European writers.
Well, the book was, I think, taken to be a kind of whole-scale denunciation of Western literature and culture, and misread and misconstrued in those terms, both by the book's many detractors on the right, but also by a number of people either on the left or in Islamist movements that looked with great suspicion on Western learning, Western intellectual traditions. The impact of a book is, of course, measured not only by the influence that it has, but on the number of misreadings that it inspires.
Well, at the time, I was one of those Marxist types whose critique of Orientalism was that if you're going to unmask Orientalism as an ideology, you need an analysis of the reality that it is concealing and distorting, the actual relations, the real relations of dominance and resistance that exist in the Middle East. And Orientalism, of course, didn't do that. This was fairly conventional Orthodox Marxist objection. But this was the era when theory had become dominant in literary studies in the United States, especially French theory, starting with Foucault, who Edward was a champion of, and then Jacques Derrida. His deconstruction, you know, provoked the left with his doctrine of undecidability. The French literary theorists in America claimed to be engaging in a form of political action, a critique of domination, even though they wrote in a kind of private language that was mostly read by grad students in Comp Lit. Edward eventually broke with theory, in quotes. What were his reasons?
I mean, Orientalism, as you say, was very indebted to French theory, but really especially to Foucault. He never had much interest in Derrida's work. And certainly the very fact that Orientalism omitted any discussion of the lived reality of the Middle East and focused on the Middle East as discursive formation was Foucauldian through and through. Yeah. But you also see in that book, especially in the last third of it, a shift from Foucault's vision of a discursive formation towards a more politically engaged analysis influenced by, on the one hand, Antonio Gramsci with his critique of hegemony, and on the other, by Noam Chomsky with his analysis of how consent is manufactured in otherwise democratic societies. And by the late 1970s, early 1980s, Said's interests had shifted decisively towards figures like Noam Chomsky and also the British art critic and essayist John Berger, who was very interested in how the oppressed and the subaltern resist, and who believed that no system of oppression is ever entirely totalizing. There are always pockets of resistance, and the point of analysis is to identify what those points of resistance might be and to profit from them. And so Said very much moved in that direction. I think also what happened was that as Said became a more renowned and public figure and became increasingly comfortable with himself, he found that he could shake off some of the encumbrances of theoreticism and jargon and all the kind of academic stuff that I think for reasons of power and prestige might have felt necessary to him at one point. He realized, no, he could write in a more colloquial style. He could write in a more direct fashion. And that's really how his work changed in those years. And you see that already in a book like The World, the Text, and the Critic, in which he really announces his break with French theory and his turn towards a more political, quote-unquote, worldly criticism.
So he became not just the voice of Palestine for Americans, but as you have mentioned, he became an advisor to Yasser Arafat and the PLO. He urged Arafat to negotiate a two-state solution, and then the Oslo Accords between Israel and the Palestinians were finally signed in 1993. How did that work out for Edward Said?
Right. Well, I mean, Edward Said's career is filled with paradoxes. Like any good intellectual, he became an advisor to Arafat around 1974 when he helped to draft Arafat's November 74 address to the United Nations, and it was Edward Said who contributed the line about not allowing the olive branch to fall from my hand. He at the time was essentially a supporter of a two-state solution, which is the position that he advocated in the question of Palestine, which did not win him many admirers among his Palestinian comrades at the time. He also expressed, you know, reservations about the efficacy of armed struggle. He wasn't against armed struggle per se. He wasn't a pacifist, but he believed that the Palestinian movement's strength lay in civil resistance and in the moral case of Palestine as a human rights and anti-colonial issue. The Palestinians were vastly outnumbered militarily. There was no way they could fight Israel. And so he believed that they had to focus on different methods of pressing their case. Now, by the late 1980s, early 1990s, Said becomes increasingly disenchanted with Arafat's rule for a number of reasons. Partly, it's the disaster of the Lebanese civil war and the PLO's involvement in that. Partly, it's the growing corruption of the PLO's bureaucrats, which he observes close up in their exile in Tunis. Partly it is Arafat's decision to fully back Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War, which is a calamitous and forces the PLO to negotiate prematurely because they had lost so much funding and all these Palestinians had been kicked out of Kuwait. And so by the time the Oslo Accords are signed in 1993, he has become increasingly frustrated with Arafat, and he sees this agreement as a capitulation to Israel, in which instead of defending Palestinian borders, Palestinians will be defending Israeli security and essentially providing the Israelis with the gendarme and not really realizing the project of Palestinian self-determination. So his position at that point begins to shift from two states to binationalism.
And what was the response of the PLO to Edward Said's critique of Oslo?
Well, the PLO never officially responded to Said. However, at a certain point, Said's books in Arabic, not in English, but his books in Arabic were banned in the Palestinian Authority, which essentially meant that unless you, you know, read English, you couldn't read Said's work, the work of the most important, undeniably the most important Palestinian intellectual of his time. The books were banned. A number of the people close to Edward came to have his view of Oslo. So I do think he was quite prescient. But at the time, he was seen as a naysayer, certainly. And there were those who grumbled that, after all, Said had the luxury of high-handedly denouncing the Oslo Accords, because after all, he had a nice apartment on the Upper West Side. He could go wherever he wanted to. He wasn't confined to the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. So there were those criticisms. But I think today his position is viewed as quite a prescient one.
And then he changed his position on Palestine and the Middle East. He gave up the fight for an independent Palestinian state, and he became one of the first advocates of a single binational secular democratic state that would guarantee equal rights to Jews and Arabs. That was huge, and that was pretty daring at the time, wasn't it?
Well, he was one of a number of people, I think, who adopted this view. Of course, later, his friend Tony Judt would make a splash in the New York Review of Books by essentially making the same argument. It was bold, but I think what was remarkable about his defense of binationalism, whether or not you agree about its feasibility, were the terms in which he cast it. And they were the terms that really marked his criticism as an intellectual in his writings on everything from literature to freedom of speech. I mean, an emphasis on equality, on dialogue, on coexistence, on having a place for different narratives that didn't necessarily fit, and an insistence on a kind of universal humanism.
And all the time that he was speaking out for Palestine and reshaping post-colonial studies, he was playing the piano and he was writing about classical music, writing for you at The Nation. I remember that we brought him to UC Irvine, where I'm on the faculty, to give some endowed lectures in 1990. He had a grand piano set up in the lecture hall, and he talked about music in the writing of Adorno, Proust, and Benjamin, and then he played examples from Beethoven, Wagner, and Strauss. We loved it. He loved doing it. Let's talk about Edward as a musician and as a music critic.
I think that there's a tendency to see Edward's love of music and his writings on music as a kind of dandyish pastime, separate from his writings on literature, on culture, on politics, separate, to be sure, from his advocacy of the Palestinian cause. But in my view, these are all interwoven. And he was very fond of Goethe's remark that art is about a voyage to the other. And I think this is really how he understood music. I think this is why he named the music ensemble for Arab and Israeli youth musicians, the Youth Orchestra, the West East Divan Orchestra, which was a tribute to Goethe's West East Divan, a collection of poems inspired by Hafez, the Persian poet. Music was also a great passion for Edward because it was a kind of artistic expression of what he called counterpoint. He loved counterpoint in intellectual argument. He loved it in music. This is one of the reasons why he was obsessed with Glenn Gould. He went to every Glenn Gould concert that he could when he was a graduate student at Harvard. He wrote one of his most memorable essays on Gould, Glenn Gould, as intellectual. Music for Edward was not simply a matter of enjoyment, not simply a matter of aesthetic beauty. It was also a way of thinking. And I think that music permeates his writing practice. You cannot separate Said's writing from his music. The two really go hand in hand. And one of the most fascinating aspects of Said's career is the turn in his last years to a concept that he discovered in Adorno, the concept of late style. Adorno had theorized that in Beethoven's late sonatas, late quartets, Beethoven was creating music that was not an expression of a kind of serene wisdom. It was not a summing up. There was nothing graceful about it. It was an explosion. It was these were works of difficulty. They were sometimes works of intense fragmentation, of daring dissonances. He called them the catastrophes of music. And Said was very much drawn to this idea of late style because I think it also spoke to his experience as a Palestinian intellectual who had broken with the mainstream of the Palestinian movement and who essentially decided, I would prefer the dissonance and difficulty of my life living apart from the movement that I've devoted myself to for three decades than accept this false peace of Oslo. His writing was his late style. His late style was his way of being a Palestinian intellectual and being a man in the world.
Adam Schatz is the nation's former literary editor. He wrote about Edward Said for the London Review of Books. Thank you, Adam. This was great.
Thanks so much, John. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Our audio engineer is William Broughton. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Frank Reynolds is our executive producer. Annie Shields is The Nation's engagement editor. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. You can subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Pocket Casts. I'm John Wiener. Tune in to Start Making Sense next week for more political talk without the boring parts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.